This is the Nichols Patrick Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of October the 20th, 2014. I'm Ed Zollers, and we're going to talk about some of the developments that have occurred this week in federal taxes. This update is brought to you by your State Society of CPAs and Nichols Patrick CPA Incorporated. Any use of this audio without the written consent of your State Society of CPAs and Nichols Patrick CPA Incorporated is prohibited. The audio is copyright 2014, Nichols Patrick CPA Incorporated. This week we've had a few developments. We're going to take a look at some of them and how they've gone this week, going a little bit quickly. We have a number of them, number of interesting little ones, maybe nothing huge, but maybe for some of you, some of this could be more important than for others. First one could be important if you in fact have a client who offers a van pool benefit. In information letter 2014-0028, the IRS compared the various ways one could offer a van pool benefit to employees in a tax beneficial status. The issue arose from a letter written to a constituent, or I should say a letter from a senator with a question from a constituent related to whether his employer was properly handling a rule under the van pool benefits for including things in W-2s. And it discussed the various options here. The key question the employee had was the thing called the 80-50 rule. And basically, what ends up happening in this case is this involves a case where an employer provides a van and sends that van around to pick up employees, bringing them back to the location. If an employer does that, it has to meet the definition of a commuter highway vehicle, which means it has to have a seating capacity of at least 6 adults, and at least 80% of the mileage used can reasonably be expected to be for transporting employees between their residence and place of employment and for use on trips where the number of employees for such purposes is at least 50% of the seating capacity. Now, the discussion here was that if an employer provides the van, and whether the employer pays for the driver or if the employer reimburses employees for the expenses involved, it has to meet the 80-50 rule. However, if the employer instead gives employees money to pay for a private van pool service, that's considered a transit pass. That still has to meet the 6-person rule, so there has to be at least 6 people in the vehicle besides the driver, so you can't pay for a taxi trip each day for the employee. But that is also excludable. That does not worry about the rules about having to be used mainly to transport employees. So the idea is involved in that area. If you have an employer who is providing this sort of benefit, you might want to take a look at this info letter to see exactly what the various breakdowns are for exactly what the employer is doing versus what the rules are for that particular case. In the case of Burrell versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2014-217, this is a simple case of a taxpayer who simply didn't keep good records. In this case, Ms. Burrell did a lot of gambling, shall we say. In fact, we had this where she had basically had winnings that ran for the 3 years in question, reported winnings, that is, from $338,100 in her high year to $226,563 in the low year. She claimed an offsetting amount for gambling losses. Ms. Burrell went in apparently and mainly played the slots. Now, she did have some reports from the casinos that told the losses at that casino. She also had some information about ATM withdrawals she made while at the casino. But she didn't have records. She had records each day of how much cash she took to the casino, but she had no records of how much she brought back. The tax court noted that that is a major deficiency. We've had previously some cases, and you may remember last year we had in the case of Sang Jae Park and Kwang O versus Commissioner, which was a 2013-2 case early in 2013, we had the tax court, in essence, endorse what a chief counsel memorandum had provided for a daily kind of, you know, overall net wins or losses on slot machines ledger that would work. The problem in Burrell's case was she didn't have the end-of-day numbers to go with that. So the tax court agreed and only allowed the losses to the extent the IRS said they were allowable. This dramatically reduced her losses claimed on the return. That's a problem because, honestly, most likely with the way that casinos work and with the way the slot machines work, it's highly likely she had additional losses, but she had no records to back up those additional losses, And she basically was the reason why there was a problem with her losses, so the court did not feel the need to attempt to apply the Cohen doctrine to estimate additional losses for her. Langert versus Commissioner, Tax Crime and Random Decision 2014-210, discusses the issue about a taxpayer, which a few people had done during the heyday of the real estate boom, went out and loaned money to people to buy property. And then it turns out these people couldn't repay him. Well, this individual made a loan back a few years ago, and a couple of issues that came up was he never did secure the loan with the real property. He never asked the couple to show him that they could financially repay, nor did he actually take a look at whether or not they were capable of repaying. A number of years go by, this couple finally stops paying, eventually files bankruptcy. Mr. Langert did not file a claim in the bankruptcy case either. Now, he took a deduction for a loss on the loan, and the IRS had three different objections to this loss. First thing is, the IRS said Mr. Langert failed to show it was a bona fide debt. Also said he failed to show if it was a bona fide debt, it became worthless in 2009. And even if both of those points were conceded, the IRS held that he had failed to show he was in the business of loaning money. Interesting enough, the tax court decided primarily to focus on the question of if he was in the business. The tax court made it very clear, if you read between the lines, in fact, it makes it very clear that they do not believe he showed 2009 was the year it went worthless anyway, if it was, and implicitly suggests that they probably wouldn't have found a bona fide debt very possibly in any event. But they did find that here's the problem. He wanted to tip business bad debt because that's an ordinary loss above the line. Very useful compared to a non-business bad debt, which would have been a short-term capital loss. And if you don't have long-term capital gains or short-term capital gains to offset that, it's going to take him a long time to recover this loan. Well, it turns out the IRS went back and looked and said he had only made six loans over a 30-year period. He claimed, well, I made this loan because I wanted to make money off interest. And they said, well, that's not good enough. That doesn't put you in the business of doing it, because somebody who just goes down to Bank of America and deposits money in a CD is wanting to make money off the CD, but that doesn't make all of us in the business of in loaning money. So the court found that, in fact, it was not a non-business bad debt. Court also found in a footnote that even if, you know, it doesn't matter, and even if we consider the non-business aspect of it, reality was he didn't show it was 2009 anyway. My guess is he had no significant capital gains, so if it was allowed as a non-business bad debt, it was going to be a very, very minor, shall we say, difference in tax. So the court dismissed that quickly and never even discussed the bona fide aspect of it. Remember, a taxpayer claiming a bad debt deduction has to show that, in fact, the debt was bona fide and that the debt actually went bad in the year in which they claimed it went bad. In essence, there's something to show when you're going to write off the entire debt. Why is that true? There has to be an identifiable event that shows that. In this case, the court found he did neither. Chief Counsel Memorandum 2014-42054 considers an interesting aside. We know that there's a special 10-year carryback for product liability losses for net operating losses. But what happens if you have a consolidated group and one of the subsidiaries has a major product liability problem, and that subsidiary actually ends up filing bankruptcy, and at the end of the day, your shares are essentially voided out and shares are issued normally in a case like that to the creditors. Now, this company went under because of a product liability issue. The taxpayer in this question, the corporation, claimed that as a loss that was a specified product liability loss. The chief counsel memorandum concludes, no, it's not that. And it does that by looking at the definition of a specified product liability loss. And it says that particular type of loss requires it to be a liability of the taxpayer and the loss to relate from the product liability itself, in essence, the expenses incurred with relation to the product liability. This was simply the loss on a belly-up subsidiary. As such, it did not qualify in the view of the chief counsel's office for the 10-year carryback provision. Also from the chief counsel's office, chief counsel advice 2014-42048, this is a moving company that was using the recurring item exception to to take a deduction for damages to goods that were incurred when it was moving goods for their various customers. And the court and what the IRS looked at here was the recurring item exception is not available for every particular deduction. Rather, it must be a deduction for which the regulations, revenue rulings, revenue procedures provide an economic performance test. In this case, the chief counsel advice concludes that these liability for moving expenses were not in the nature of insurance or warranty expenses. As such, they could not qualify. There was no other category they could fall into. Not falling into that category, they do not qualify for the recurring item exception. Therefore, the standard economic performance rules apply. As you should be aware, the recurring item exception would have allowed the taxpayer to take a deduction for as long as actually made payments on these damage claims all the way through 8.5 months after the end of the year. For the taxpayer, this is going to shorten it up dramatically for such accrued expenses. Therefore, that's why the client taxpayer wanted the recurring item exception. As it points out, to have the recurring item exceptions, you have to be able to identify which category of expense that's eligible for the recurring item exception your particular deduction falls into. Next, Chief Counsel Advice 2014-42049 is a good reminder. I often hear people get confused about this. This was looking at whether or not, and we don't worry about the details of why there's an accounting method change coming here. It involves various things involving an investment advisor and certain participation rights he had and how he was recording. We're not going to worry much about that side of the equation. The bigger issue here, though, that was discussed was once this change of method is done, the service is thinking of forcing him to change his method. It turns out that under the method that the service believes he should have been using, he should have recognized significant income 4 years ago. We all know there's a 3-year statute, so 4 years would be a problem. What the agent was asking the national office was, are we able to, with an accounting method change, go ahead and pick up and force him to report that income? Or, with this change in method, do we have to basically say, well, that's a closed year, so the fact he didn't report the income that year and we're claiming he should have, well, tough luck, we didn't examine him in time. And as the chief counsel advice points out, in fact, 481A requires you to go back to day one and recompute the income. And that does mean that that income cumulatively that should have been recognized but has not been recognized does go into that 4-year spread adjustment. When you say, but wait, that's a closed year. Years close only for assessment of taxes, so the IRS cannot go back and get tax from that year and make an assessment against that year. But remember, the 41A adjustment puts income into the year in which the change is made. That will be a year under exam that is open. Therefore, the IRS has the perfect right to move that up. This is something that's going to come up quite a bit as we do our change of accounting methods for the repair regulations this year. Yes, you're going to be impacting quote-unquote closed years. So, be very careful. A lot of people misunderstand the concept of closed years. This chief counsel advice just points out that, in fact, for an accounting method change, it's not really a relevant issue. In the case of Morehouse versus Commissioner, this is one that had been discussed previously. You may have remembered that back a year ago that we had the tax court a little while back in Morehouse versus Commissioner telling us that basically CRP payments were self-employment income even for taxpayers that did not directly participate in the farm. The tax court ruled such payments were not rent. Rent is excluded from self-employment income. Therefore, the only way you could exclude those from income is if you could show the person did not basically regularly carry on the trade or business. The tax court did that because the Sixth Circuit, in a case called Wubker, had concluded that such payments were not rent. Now, Morehouse was appealed to the Eighth Circuit, and the Eighth Circuit took a look at Revenue Ruling 60-32. And the court notes that while the IRS in Notice 2006-108 issued a proposed revenue ruling that would have made these not treated as if they were rents, and that notice was issued after the Wubker case, the Sixth Circuit found that the IRS still had to follow Revenue Ruling 60-32, or at least the majority of the panel. Now, the dissenter complained bitterly that, A, the panel really didn't ever quite deal with the fact that the Sixth Circuit had apparently said, look, it's not rent. If it's not rent, it can't meet the exclusion. so we have to test for whether the person is actively conducting a trade or business. Number two, this said, if that's true, then we really just have that test. He said, you know, basically, the Eighth Circuit did not indicate clearly how you reconcile Morehouse with Wupker. They tried to reconcile it by saying, well, Wupker was an active farmer and Morehouse wasn't. Doesn't really seem, and I think the dissent has this right, that that was the Sixth Circuit's analysis. The Sixth Circuit's analysis simply said it's not rent. Not rent is not rent, whether or not you're actively involved. Active involvement may impact whether you're actively conducting a trade or business, but that's a different concept. Nevertheless, it does look like we have a split here between the Eighth and Sixth Circuit on the treatment of CRP payments, at least as relates to a taxpayer who's not actively involved in, who's not actively farming. We also have a series of private letter rulings here, 2014-42-042, 043, 044, 045, 046, that were issued. Turns out that we had a grat mistakenly managed to make the trust that was to receive the residual a grantor trust. Oops. The attorney who drafted it initially insisted that was no problem to the accountant who put a note in the file. Later, another financial advisor got involved, indicated again it was a problem. This time we brought in another attorney, found it was. The IRS did allow the taxpayer to go to state court, reform the trust, and not worry about having to move his gift up to the date of reformation. Rather, they treated the trust as if they had been proper from the first day. But the problem here, of course, is having to apply for five separate private letter rulings. Regulation 13666, proposed Reg 136676-13, the IRS is proposing to remove the 36-month 1099-C test. This is something the IRS had previously mentioned in a notice earlier. They were planning on doing it. That 36-month test is a mechanical test where a 1099-C is issued if somebody has not made a payment for 36 months and there's no active collection efforts. The IRS suggests that that's been a confusing test. It doesn't really indicate the date on which cancellation took place. Remember that issue we had earlier with the debt? So the question becomes very quickly, well, if that's not indicating that, why is the test there? It was put in there initially because financial institutions wanted some sort of objective test. The service believes that it's been a failure, shall we say, the way they look at it. So the proposed reg is offering to pull it away. It is still not gone, but it will be interesting to see if the IRS takes this regulation final before the end of this year. And if they do, whether that will affect 1099-Cs issued for this year. Finally, Reinhart versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum 2014-218. The IRS got in trouble by making an assumption here. The IRS attempted to collect an assessment more than 10 years after. Attempted to collect on an assessment more than 10 years after it was made. That's generally outside the statute. However, there is a provision if the taxpayer continuously resides outside the United States for more than 6 months, that the taxpayer, basically the statute, is continued. What turns out in this case was the IRS apparently had assumed that this particular person was living outside the United States because she was filing a joint return with her husband, which gave a Bermuda address. But it turns out that in reality, this person had been mainly living in Florida. She had much testimony to show it, and she got records from Homeland Security that showed her trips to and from Florida. So because of that, the court found that, in fact, the IRS had not managed to show that she lived outside the U.S., for an extended period that would have caused the statute to be open. Because of that, because this assessment had been in 93, the 10-year statute expired in 2003, and sorry, IRS, you're just late to the game. This has been the current federal tax developments for this week. Be sure to check back next week when we'll discuss the developments that occur in the coming weeks in the area of federal taxes.